is Over the Garden Gate, a program brought to you by the University of California Cooperative Extension Master Gardener Program of Tuolumne County. The mission of the UCCE Master Gardeners is to provide research-based gardening information to the public. If you would like to contact our Master Gardener Program, please call our hotline, which is area code 209-533-5912. The hotline is not manned full-time, but we do pick up our messages and we will get back to you within the week.
Hello, everybody. This is Debbie Powell. I'm the Master Gardener Coordinator for both Calaveras and Tuolumne County. We are so fortunate for our virtual open garden to have Sue Mosbacher and Chris DeRose as our presenters for our topic called Preserving Your Harvest.
So thank you guys for being here today. I'm excited to share the passion that Chris and I both have for food preservation. Okay, so I'm gonna start a little bit. Many of you are probably Master Gardeners. You've attended their events, so you know the Master Gardeners teach research-based information on home gardening, and we take the next step. And once you've harvested everything, we teach research-based practices for safe home food preservation. So all of the recipes and the methods that we're going to be talking about today are research-based, so that you know that they've been proven to be effective and safe. Our main goal is to make sure people don't get sick. Here's our website, ucanr.edu/mfpcs for Master Food Preservers Central Sierra. On that website, we have phone numbers for helpline. You can send emails for help questions. On our website, you can ask a Master Food Preserver and submit questions there. And then we have active Facebook pages in Amador County and El Dorado, and people answer questions there as well. Throughout this presentation, we're going to be showing lots of products, talking about lots of products. They're all examples. None of them are endorsements. So we're going to start with food safety basics. The first thing is food safety starts before you get into the kitchen. It's out when you're out in the garden. So when you're harvesting your produce, you want to make sure that you're using clean tools and a clean container, and then knock the clods of dirt off of your product. If you've got, you know, a zucchini that's been sitting on the ground, it's got a lump of mud on the bottom, just brush it off, use your hands to rub it off. You only want to rinse the product just before you're using it. You don't want to waterlog it, and you don't want to soak it in water. You want to just use water and rinse it off. Make sure you clean and sanitize your work area and your tools. One benefit of this pandemic is we all know how to clean our counters, and we know how to clean our hands and sanitize our work area. So make sure you take care of that. And then you want to have your hair either pulled back or covered. And the common and most obvious result of this is so that your hair doesn't get into your food. But the other thing is, you don't want to be fussing with your hair and pulling it back out of your face and touching your hair and then touching the food. You want to keep your hands clean. And so by having it pulled back, and Chris will be demonstrating that, I'm not going to be working with any food. So keep your hair pulled back. If you have hair that tends to fly out no matter what, you can wear a bandana or some kind of a head covering. Make sure you have on a clean apron, because the purpose of the apron is not only to protect your food from anything that splatters, but more importantly, to protect your food from anything you have on your clothes. If you have pets or you've been going inside and outside, your clothes probably aren't as clean as they should be for working in a sanitary kitchen environment. So having a clean apron protects your food from you. And then make sure your toes are covered. If you're gonna be working with hot water, things splash, burns the toes, slippery hands can drop knives, and want to make sure that you've got a layer of protection with your toes. All right, so that's the setup. The food preservation, why we do it. There's a main reason, and that's to keep foodborne pathogens from growing in our food. Pathogens grow in our food, we eat it, we get sick. So we want to make sure that they do not grow. So we do that one of two ways. We either destroy the pathogens or we inhibit their growth. So the way that we have long-term storage methods to do this is we can freeze food, and that prevents the pathogens from growing. It does not kill them. I like to think of it as little bear bacteria in hibernation. So they're still alive, they're just not doing anything, just laying there, staying alive. And once you thaw them, then the bacteria is still alive and it will continue to grow. Dehydrating gets rid of the moisture. Pathogens need moisture to grow. So if you get rid of the moisture, the pathogens can't grow. And when we dehydrate fruits and vegetables, we remove enough moisture so that there's only about 20% moisture remaining in fruit and 10% moisture in vegetables. And at those levels, as long as you've stored it properly, bacteria will not grow. So with those two, we inhibit the growth of the bacteria. With canning, we have to destroy it. And so when we can, our goal is to destroy all the molds, bacteria, yeast, parasites, anything that might be in there. And so we destroy the foodborne pathogens, and then we create a sealed and essentially pasteurized shelf-stable product. So the bacteria, well, there isn't any that's left, but there's nothing to grow. So we have two different canning methods, and the item that determines how we choose which method we use is the acidity of the food. So over here in this yellow section, we have fruits and a pickled product. So if we can take a vegetable and we acidify it with vinegar, it has a high enough acid that we can use our boiling water canner. Tomatoes are kind of borderline, figs are borderline, Asian pears are borderline, and so we're going to make sure we acidify those so that they're safely up in this range. So for those products, we use a boiling water canner or an atmospheric steam canner. With low acid foods, and those are vegetables and meats and dairies, things like that, we don't can dairy. But if we were gonna can vegetables and meats and beans, we would use a pressure canner. And I'm gonna explain why in a moment. We're not going to demonstrate pressure canning today. I just wanna make sure you understand that if you're gonna be canning just straight vegetables, then you would pressure can it. And in the core canning basics handout, it has the instructions for that. All right, so why the two canning methods? It's all because of the bacteria Clostridium botulinum. It's a tricky little bugger. It does not grow in high acid foods, but it grows in low acid foods. So if we have this bacteria in a jam or a jelly or in a jar of peaches, it won't grow because those are high acid foods. We can be eating them and our stomach is very acidic, and so it won't grow, it'll just pass through. The environment that it needs to grow is a low acid food, which is our vegetables and meats, moist, and so water, and it can't grow in oxygen, it needs an anaerobic environment, and it needs to grow at room temperature. So if you take a can of green beans and you cover it with boiling water, and then you have that in your jar, you have a low acid food, you've got the water in there, so there's moisture. When you can it, you force all the air out, so now you have an anaerobic environment, and it's up on your counter, which is room temperature. So that's the perfect environment. And so when it's in that environment, it will grow and create a toxin that's called botulinum. And when you open up that jar and you serve it for dinner and you eat it, then you can get the disease botulism. So what we have to do is make sure we kill it. Well, unfortunately, when it's in an environment where it can't grow, like out on the dirt or on our vegetables, it creates this spore, a protective spore around it. And it's very hard and it does its job well. And its job is to keep the bacteria alive and protected until it's in an environment where it can grow. The spore is very strong and hardy, and it takes a temperature of 240 degrees to kill the spore, which you then will kill the bacteria. And no matter how hard you boil, how hard of a boil you have and how many bubbles, you're never gonna get to 240 degrees. So you have to use a pressure canner to increase the temperature to 240 degrees. So that's why you would need a pressure canner to kill low acid foods. And there's no uniform distribution. We don't know where the bacteria is. So we assume that it will always be present. It's better safe than sorry. So anytime we're canning just a straight low acid food, we pressure can it to ensure that if the bacteria is there, it's killed. So that's why there's two methods. We are gonna be just talking about high acid foods, not the low acid foods today. So we're gonna be able to just use boiling water and steam canner. All right, so the recipes that we're going to use, we want to make sure people use current reputable recipes and methods. And that means that the recipes themselves or the process is based on research. A lot of things have changed since grandma's canning days. The acidity of vinegar has changed. They've done research to show that just because you scrape off the mold on jelly doesn't mean that there's more mold that you can't see throughout the jar. There's there have been changes and we want to make sure that people stay safe. And so the recipes that you use need to follow the USDA or the National Center for Home Food Preservation recommendations. So that means we don't do open kettle canning. And open kettle canning is where you take hot food, you put it in hot jars, you fill it up almost to the top, you put a lid and a ring on it, you turn the jar upside down, it forces the air out to create a vacuum seal. You may have a sealed jar, but the air that was in there wasn't sterilized, and we have all kinds of stuff floating around in our air as far as the pathogen world goes, and you didn't pasteurize or sterilize the product to make sure that nothing will grow in there. So that's not a method we recommend. We don't recommend canning in the oven. And sometimes people will say, but my oven gets up, you know, I can it at 360 degrees, and that's, you know, a lot higher than boiling water. But the heat transfer in the oven is very different than the heat transfer in boiling water. I have no problem taking my plain old bare hand with a thermometer, sticking it in a 400 degree oven to put something, you know, to check the temperature of the meat and pulling it out. I would never do that in boiling water. It's because heat transfers differently in air than it does in water. And so we want to make sure that our recipes have been tested for boiling water, and that's what we use, or the process. And then we don't use the paraffin wax seals anymore. We don't recommend those. When people did paraffin wax sealing, mainly with jams and jellies, a lot of folks had a root cellar. And you would keep the jars at a consistent temperature. And so the wax would complete the seal. Well, again, we have the same issues with open kettle canning. We didn't process it, so there could have been pathogens still in the product that can grow. And also, when winter comes and the cold constricts the wax, it can pull away from the side of the jar. Pathogens can go in. In my house, ants would go in. And then when the wax warms up, it will reseal all those things inside the product. And so we don't recommend using a wax seal either. And so a lot of times people will say, well, I want to can this fabulous restaurant with a recipe that has these vegetables and all this good stuff. If you don't have a recipe, just put it in the freezer. It works fine that way because then the pathogens won't grow. But you don't want to take a risk of getting people sick. All right, so that in a nutshell is the basic food safety. In the handouts that will be on the website, there's the food safety basics. It has a lot more information. And again, we're going to email it to you after after the class. Not today, I'm not promising that. And then there's also the National Center for Home Food Preservation. It has a lot of information on it as well. So are there any basic questions on the food safety issues before we move on to freezing?
There aren't any questions in the chat.
Perfect. I'm a minute ahead of schedule. This is the only time that happens. All right, so we're going to move on to freezing highlights. And it's interesting because people have been freezing a long time. But there are just two main things that I want to talk about for freezing, just to help have some more successful freezing experiences with your food. And one, I want to address creating an acceptable texture, because you're never going to have the same quality and texture of a product coming out of the freezer as you go in. And so I want to show you or explain what you can do to help make it good and not too mushy. And then also the big concern is no freezer burn. This happens a lot in my house when people try and help clean up afterwards, and they'll take, you know, a bag of mixed vegetables and just roll it up, put a rubber band around it so it doesn't fall out, and throw it in the freezer, and then this is what comes out. And so I want to make sure everybody understands what freezer burn is and how we can prevent it. Okay, so first, the acceptable texture. We need to understand what happens when we put food in the freezer. There's natural water in all foods. When water freezes, it expands. And so that means that the water in our food is expanding, and those ice crystals, they rupture the cell walls. That's why you get the mushy food, because the water has broken down the tissues. And one thing to know is when frozen food, where the water molecules, when they start to warm up, they will migrate together, they clump together, they make larger drops of water, which makes, when you refreeze it, you have a larger ice crystal. you have a larger ice crystal, it's going to do more damage to your cell walls. So if you have things thawing, almost thawing, warming up a little bit and then freezing again, warming up and freezing again, the texture is going to be very poor because it's going to keep rupturing the cells and they're mush. So the big thing is if you want small ice crystals, you need to freeze the foods fast. And then you want to keep the foods frozen. Again, the water molecules will clump together. You want to make sure that you have small droplets of water in your food and not large ones. And as an FYI, thawed foods spoil faster than fresh food, because the cell walls, they're ruptured, so the bacteria has easier access to the nutrients that are in your food. So it's another reason why you want to make sure you thaw your foods in the refrigerator and not on the counter, because the bacteria will grow even more rapidly at room temperature than it will in the refrigerator. So we want to keep our foods frozen. So that means you don't stand at the refrigerator or at the freezer door and try and figure out what am I going to have for dinner. In my house, I tend to keep my juices, any frozen broths, things like that, where it doesn't matter what the texture is, on my the freezer door, because that's what's going to be the warmest area. And so if those thaw and freeze, they're liquid, so it's not going to impact the texture. But that could be a cause of why you've got problems with texture on some of the other foods if they're warming up and refreezing. Okay, so preventing freezer burn. Freezer burn is just moisture that's in the food. It's evaporated into air in your container in the freezer, and then it freezes. And sometimes you get the little stalagmites growing up, sometimes just a frost over them, and then the food will start to discolor. It's pretty gross. So things that you want to do before you put things in the freezer is to remove surface moisture. If you get rid of the extra moisture, that's not going to freeze outside of your product. And then you want to make sure you use freezer containers. These are designed to keep air out. If you just throw something in the freezer in a sandwich baggie, sandwich baggies are designed to let air move in and out, because otherwise you'll have a soggy sandwich from the condensation. So you need to make sure that you do use freezer containers. And a lot of them will have a little snowflake on the bottom. And so that way you know it is designed to be a freezer container. And then you buy specific freezer container plastic bags. And then once you've got the right container, you want to get as much air out and then keep it out. Because if there isn't any air for the moisture to evaporate into, then it won't have the ice crystals that freeze because there's no air. So there's a couple of things you can do. And Chris is going to show you a very simple method where you take a straw in a plastic bag and you push as much air out of it as possible. And then with the straw in at the very last part of the non-zipped bag seal, you just breathe in and pull out as much air as you can. And it's amazing how much air you can get rid of in a bag that way. You can also use commercial vacuum sealers. And also if you have these type of containers, just a hard-sided container, and if there's extra space in there, then go ahead and either like lay some plastic wrap across the top or scrunch up some freezer paper like this. This is peaches in a syrup. And so the peaches are actually under the liquid, so they won't get freezer burn, but then you might still have some ice crystals on the top. So you can take up the space in there with some crumpled up parchment or freezer paper. Okay, another thing is if you've got canning jars, they are tempered to go in the hot water and also into the freezer. But you wanna make sure that you use jars that have straight edges and not the rounded shoulders, because if you have liquid in there, freezing water is just like a glacier. It will force its way through. It would be nice if it would conform to the shape of the container, but it doesn't. So you could have cracked jars if you have food that expands up and breaks the shoulders of the jar. But it's interesting. You can buy wide mouth jars that are designed for freezing, and they will say on here, for freezing, fill here. It's kind of hard to see that part. But there's this little seam right underneath the bottom rim. It's kind of hard to see, but there's a little line. And that tells you when you're putting in something that may expand, tomato sauce, pesto, juices, whatever, that's the line you fill it to so that there's room to expand in the rest of the jar. But you don't have to buy just jars that are designed for the freezer or marketed for the freezer. All of your wide mouth canning jars, if you look at them, they have this little rim underneath there, and that's at about a 1.5 inch head space. And so that's the line that you use to fill liquids or liquid-like products in your freezer. And so that way they won't break. So you already have a lot of freezer containers in your cupboards. All right, so another thing that is very common is to do a tray pack. Sometimes it's called a dry pack or an individual quick freeze, IQF. And that's where you take whole produce and that you want to use individually and you freeze them individually. When I first moved to our property here, we have all these wild blackberries and I was so excited. And I picked them, I rinsed them, I dried them off and I put them in a baggie. And when I pulled it out, I had one clump of frozen berries. It's like, well, I guess I'm using them all at one time. So since then I've learned. And so what you do is you take the berries, you can, I've done this with green beans, I've done it with sliced peppers, you can do it with rhubarb chunks, just about anything, where you rinse them off, dry them, you wanna get the moisture off as much as possible, and put them on a small tray or a plate. I like to put parchment paper underneath it, you can use a silicon mat or aluminum foil, and then you put that in the freezer. And I like to use a little toaster oven tray, it's a nice quarter size cookie sheet, fits perfectly. And then you freeze them when they're frozen individually, then you move them to a container. And so here's some of my blackberries, and it's nice when you've got either parchment paper or foil or silicon pad underneath it, you can just pick that up and then pour it into a bag or a container. And that way, when you want just a handful of berries or just a handful of peppers, you can take just a few. And then just a reminder, we had this the other night as we were sitting watching TV, frozen berries and frozen grapes. It's like eating candy. They're like little mini popsicles. They're delicious. All right. So I've got a couple of quick pictures here. Here's some blueberries. Here's some rhubarb slices. So they're on the trays. And then if they stick, you just take a spatula and scrape them off and then you put them in a bag. Pretty easy. All right. I have a tip. So blackberries, raspberries, they have all these little nooks and crannies where the water can get in there. And so when you freeze them, you'll have a lot of times this layer of ice over them. And so you can dry them, you can take paper towels, pat them, but if they're delicate, you may bruise them and squish them and it's impossible to get all that moisture off. A former nutrition advisor showed me this trick. You use a hairdryer on low setting and run it over the fruit. And so that way it will help force the evaporation in all those nooks and crannies in your berries. And then I do this and I pull up my berries from the freezer and they're just beautiful, dark, black, purplish berries. And I have very little frost on them. I have learned that since I don't have a diffuser, that if you just take your hair dryer and you put them on a cookie sheet and you dry the berries, they kind of roll all over the place. So I put them in a little muffin tin, and it keeps them from rolling all over. Okay, freezing tomatoes. This is the easiest way to preserve tomatoes, especially if you get a bumper crop of tomatoes and you just are not gonna be spending the next week in your kitchen canning them all. So if you freeze them, so easy. You just make sure you rinse them and dry them. You can freeze them whole. Remove the little stem scar, put them in on a tray, or you can put them in a bag and just leave the air, you know, open it up so that the air can get in there easier. When they're frozen, you put them in a freezer bag, get rid of the air, and stick them in the freezer. Date them, obviously. And then when you're ready to use, it's so nice, you run them under warm water, and I like to let them thaw just a little bit so they've got a bit of give to them, but then the skins come off. So you don't have to pre-peel them, you don't have to cut them, you don't have to core them, just remove the stem scar. And true confessions, I've put them in with the stem scar on. And so it makes it nice because then you can can them or do whatever you want. You know, cook them, make your own sauce for dinner, and you just chop them up and away you go. So it's a great way to preserve tomatoes. And then if you want to make sauces later, you can. And then here's a tip for chopped onions, but this would work with just about everything. I had a volunteer who used to buy 25-pound bags of onions, and I have another volunteer who grows lots and lots of onions. And so chop up the onions. They use one of those little quick chop tools where you just slice them and chop, 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 chop. But then what you do is you use regular baggies, not freezer baggies, the cheap ones, the twisty ties, the fold over sandwich baggies. Mark the quantity. So you may do half cup, quarter cup, full cup, different proportions that you need for meals. And then put them in the baggies, get rid of as much air if you can. And then put all those small baggies into a large freezer bag, remove the air, and then put it in the freezer. So then when you need some onions, you just pull out a bag, and then again, you get the air out of the large freezer bag and seal it back up and put it back in the freezer. But that saves you a little bit of money because freezer bags are more expensive than cheap sandwich bags. And so that way you can pre-measure your onions or peppers, chopped onions, or celery, whatever you want to use. And save a little bit of money and have everything ready to go just to pull out from the freezer. Okay, so that's the basics. Freeze food fast and keep it frozen, and then make sure there's no air and no moisture to freeze to cause your freezer burn, and use the right tools. So let's see.
Hey, Sue. We do have a question, and it's when PG&E power outage is short, like ice cream is soft, not liquid, we eat the ice cream. But what about meats and frozen fruits or veggies? Keep or toss out?
If there's still ice crystals in them, you can use them and you can refreeze them. But pay attention to the quality of it. And if it's completely thawed, you know, the general rule of thumb is, you know, if it's more than 95 degrees out, you can't keep things out for an hour, more than an hour at room temperature. So if it's been thawed for a while, you need to get rid of it, unfortunately. A full freezer will last between 2 to 4 days, shoot for 2 days. Make sure that you've always got it full. And it could just be empty milk jugs with water that freeze. But if it's frozen, if the freezer is full, it will last longer and stay colder. You can always put dry ice in there, wrap it with cardboard or moving blankets to help insulate it. But yeah, if it is thawed and has not been refrigerated, you unfortunately need to get rid of it. And I have some more information in the handouts about what to do when the power goes out, although I kind of told you. But there's also information there about pre-treating fruits and vegetables. You want to blanch vegetables, and then labeling and storage time. Labeling is very important because, trust me, frozen grapefruit juice looks a lot like frozen chicken stock, and you don't want to make that mistake of mixing the two. It also talks about thawing fruits and vegetables, and then there's some recipes. So the freezing is very easy. Some of the recipes that we have in the handout are for the zucchini basil spread, a preserved lemon kale pesto, carrot greens chimichurri, beet green pesto, cilantro pumpkin seed pesto, carrot top pesto, and then freezing tomatoes. So all kinds of things that you're growing in your garden and you may not have thought about using them this way. Hopefully you don't get rid of your carrot greens or your beet greens, but here's some fun things that you can do with them. So any questions on freezing? I know we're already behind. Oh, well.
You've been listening to Over the Garden Gate, a program presented by the UCCE Master Gardeners of Tuolumne County. I'm Linda Reevely. Thank you for being with us. If you would like to contact us for more information, remember you can contact our hotline, which is area code 209-533-5912, or you can look us up on the kaad-lp.org website. Look for Over the Garden Gate. Thank you.